On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, we react to the stunning resignation of Tony Clark as executive director of the MLB Players Association. What led to that? What has happened since, and where do we go from here? We bring in a special guest, Scott Pianowski, to get us ready for the fantasy baseball season. And then, of course, it's Friday, so we give you the good, the bad, the ugly, all that and so much more on this episode of Baseball Barbacast.
Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world that won't be talking about what's worse, brother's wife or wife's sister. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. And while we will be digging into the MLB Players Association saga, scandal, kerfuffle, whatever you like to call it, we are going to keep things relatively PG. This is a family program.
I guess. I mean, a little bit too late. Just welcoming us back. This is a great example of, you know, especially now, this is the last time we're going only twice in 1 week. We have certainly had a few instances during the offseason when we're podcasting where some significant news drops. I mean, in this case, what, minutes after we stop recording on Tuesday morning?
Minutes.
And so the reason why that is relevant is not necessarily as much like, oh man, if only we covered, but that feels so long ago now, right? I mean, we have both been spending a lot of time trying to cover this, me in person. You know, I was there when Bruce Meyer, now the new executive director, interim executive director of the MLBPA, spoke at the Kansas City Royals Complex. You have, of course, been on the phone tracking down a bunch of information and writing about this. So this feels almost like old news. I feel like this is all we've been talking about, and yet here we are on this podcast addressing this situation for the first time. And yes, quite obviously, that is our opener.
Tony Clark, the now former executive director of the MLBPA, was a larger-than-life figure at 6'7", more than two for sure. You knew when he was in a room. He was unavoidable. And for him to no longer be involved in the MLBPA is shocking and difficult for you and I to wrap our minds around because, you know, Tony had been in charge since 2013. And in our cognizant lives, he has always been the head man. Here's how this is going to go on this show, okay? We're going to explain what happened, and then we're going to explain why it matters. The upshot, the headline, MLBPA Executive Director Tony Clark resigned on Tuesday morning after an internal investigation revealed that he had an inappropriate relationship with a union employee that also happened to be his sister-in-law, his wife's sister. Now, that came out on Tuesday. There was about like a 5 to 6 to 7 hour period where we knew that Tony had resigned, but we didn't yet know why. And in that gap of time, the assumption was that it was somehow related to a variety of investigations into his financial malfeasances. We can get into that a little bit later. But then Jeff Passan reports later in the afternoon that there was indeed some inappropriate relationshipping going on. And let's not beat around the bush, Jordan. Inappropriate relationship is not, you know, going to Six Flags together. It is a little bit more carnal and salacious than that. Where would you like to begin?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of want to just skip to the part where it's like, is this important or not? And what has occurred since then? Because I think certainly, as you mentioned, the initial that gap of time where, okay, Tony's out, what does this have to do with? The reason why it was a little bit strange to think, okay, is this connected to this federal investigation into whatever financial wrongdoings or improprieties or at least not super clean things happening
not within goods.
Some business dealings? Yeah, related to LPA is we've known that this investigation has been going on for quite some time. And yeah. so the timing of, and let's also talk about the exact timing, right? The MLBPA was about to begin its tour around the spring training facilities. This is something they do every year. This is where Tony and all of the other kind of head honchos, whether that's on the legal side, whether that's the former players, it is a large contingent that goes from camp to camp and kind of just sets the tone for the season and checks in and is like, hey, players, this is what we're about. This is what our main focus is this season. Obviously, in this case, entering the final year of the CBA, this is an important time to check in and make a, you know, understand that, like, all right, these are our goals this year. This is what our messaging is going to be. If you have questions about this element, that was about to begin. That, in fact, that was supposed to start on Tuesday. Supposed to start on
and
Tuesday
as I understand
at Cleveland's camp.
Mm-hmm. You got a text Monday night from someone in the union world, like saying, hey, Tony's going to be at Cleveland camp tomorrow morning if you want to be there to talk to him.
Yep. So that is how late breaking this was.
And he wasn't there.
Fast forward to when nobody was there.
Spoilers.
And I wasn't there either, to be fair. I wasn't going to be at Cleveland camp that day either. But the point is, when that changes, it's like, okay, well, is this whole tour canceled, right? Are they now going to be in a situation where they have to kind of retreat and delay stuff until they figure it out? And it turned out that was not the case, because 24 hours later, the MLBPA contingent, this is before they have decided on who the interim is going to be, shows up at Royals camp, as do I. And so they hold their first meeting of the day, and then later that day they went to Cubs. And throughout that, at both meetings, Bruce Meyer took questions and kind of gave a general update of where things are, in which Bruce also confirmed the very recent timeline, right? I mean, he also pointed out that, listen, this is not information we've been sitting on and suddenly we decided to act on it. This is information we've received recently. And thus the player subcommittee, which now I'm going to kick it to you to kind of explain how this ended up getting voted on, both Tony being moved aside, and then also how we landed on Bruce Meyer as the interim. The player subcommittee decided, with this information, this is not someone we want leading us. And it sounds like Tony reacted being like, all right, I will move aside, which led us to a vote, which you can now explain, that led us to Bruce Meyer as the interim executive director.
Yeah, the timeline here is interesting. So as far as I understand it, the MLB Players Association subcommittee, to be clear, that is a group of eight players that kind of act, you know, for lack of a better term, above the fray, right? They are not the player reps. They all have their own votes. They are kind of they're the executive subcommittee. That is Chris Bassett, Paul Skeens, Tarek Skubal, Jake Cronenworth, Brent Suter, Cedric Mullins, Pete Fairbanks, Marcus Semien. Okay. Now, how many games does that team win with Bruce Meyer as the ninth player? No. So that group of eight, as part of this investigation into Tony Clark allegedly misusing money meant for an MLBPA charity, hired an outside lawyer named Adam Braverman to effectively update them regularly on the investigation so they could have, like, you know, objective information coming in, right? As part of that process, it appears, Braverman uncovered or learned about, was informed of Tony Clark's inappropriate relationship with his employee sister-in-law. That information was presented to the subcommittee at some point on like Monday. They then decided as a group, in talking to Tony, that Tony could not continue and Tony stepped down, right? We had the interview of Marcus Semien talking, and there was Brent Suter talking on that day. As far as we understand it, those dudes knew about what was going on. Like, when their phones buzzed, that was not the first they had heard of Tony's, like, they knew something was afoot, right? So that's how this information kind of comes to light for the players. Now, the 30 team reps did not know, like, at all. And in talking to, you know, some of them on background, off the record, like, this was a surprise to those 30 reps. Now, those 30 reps do not get to vote on their own, you know, opinions. They, whether they are voting on the CBA or they are voting on who the next director of the MLBPA is going to be, they are voting on behalf of their team. So the team kind of votes and comes to a decision, and whoever the rep is gets on the call and says, the Reds vote thus, the A's vote thus, right? They like Cal Raleigh, who's the Mariners rep, is not saying what Cal Raleigh thinks. He is saying what the Mariners think. I think that is an important distinction to understand. Mm-hmm. And it is relevant because when there was a vote to decide who the next member or the next executive director was going to be, Bruce Meyer is elected unanimously, which I do think is a strong statement. In between Tony stepping down and Bruce being elected, there were some other names thrown around, including Daniel Murphy, which is, frankly, I heard that that is just not, was never going to happen. Not sure why that was out there. Andrew Miller, Kevin Slowey, who are both former players, were definitely, those names were thrown about, as was Matt Nussbaum, who is promoted from general counsel to Bruce Meyer's old job as deputy executive director. But in the end, Bruce gets elected by a score of 72-0 to be the new executive director. That includes the 30 MLB player reps, okay, the 8 subcommittee members, and then fascinatingly, 34 minor league representatives. Now, the minor leagues were folded into the union, I believe, in 2023. And because this pertains to them, it is the executive director, they get to vote in the same way that the major leaguers get to vote. Now, in the end, it didn't matter. There were not various voting blocks that came out. And, you know, in the end, it was a pretty strong show of force unanimously for Bruce. But that is just how this whole process worked. Bruce, the news comes out, I believe, late Wednesday night, and he spoke on Thursday. He will be the new executive director of the MLB Players Association. Now, why is this all relevant? Why does this all matter? Well, first of all, the salaciousness of the Tony Clark stuff is why this is kind of like spread beyond what it otherwise might have been. If Tony Clark stepped down because he was pocketing a little extra dough, like that's bad, and arguably like worse for the like a union perspective, because that is like that is a failure to lead the sport rather than a failure of, well, you know, just morality in general.
Well,
I'm splitting hairs. That,
no, but also that also might still be a thing.
Might still happen. That's still real. Oh yeah. So, that's the thing.
Whatever.
Like, go ahead.
Whatever the reason is, I agree that, sure, yeah, it's this story's getting more retweets, fine. But no, the timing is the timing. Whatever the reason was, whatever, even if he was not doing any wrongdoing at all and he just happened to decide, all right, you know what, going into this last year of the CBA, I'm out of here. However we got here, I think that it is remarkable timing, because this is a season. If the CBA expiration was 3 or 4 years from now, it would not feel as pressing, right? But this is one of the biggest stories in baseball this season. It was already a topic, and Tony Clark has been the face of that topic. Now, I think what is important to really establish here, this is a good time to be like, who the hell's Bruce Meyer? That'd be a good thing to do, since that's probably not a conversation we've had on this podcast before fully. But also, there is a you can reasonably say, well, how much is this going to change? What impact was Tony making other than being the face of this operation? Because we know that from a negotiation standpoint, Bruce Meyer was the lead negotiator last time and said before he was elected as interim that he was going to be still leading negotiations this time, regardless of whether or not he was elected. So in that sense, right, it doesn't really change anything. But I think that it is an important change, because the voice of the union, which Bruce now is from a public standpoint, which he wasn't before, that is different. And going into a year where we are all going to be talking about this often, that is important.
It is also worth understanding why Bruce Meyer entered the union to begin with, right? So Tony Clark gets elected as the first ever former player to be executive director. And for lack of a better term, I mean, he gets his world rocked in the CBA negotiations in 2017, you know, as a non-lawyer. Like, he was underprepared and overmatched. And so brings in Bruce Meyer, who is a career labor lawyer who was at the NHL Players Association, to act as his deputy and run the negotiation and legal side of the CBA. Bruce is not a Tony was a baseball person. Bruce is a labor person. And so Bruce ran the negotiations in 2021-2022 offseason, which was generally thought to have been a win for the players and was always going to lead the charge this time around. Tony was always acting as more, not even really as a figurehead, but his role was more running the day-to-day of the union, being more player-oriented and interacting with the media, right? Bruce was like the dude in the room with Rob Manfred and Deputy Commissioner Dan Halem getting into the nitty-gritty of the CBA. And because of that dynamic, this doesn't really dramatically change, in my opinion, how negotiations will unfold this winter. It's obviously not a good thing the way that this happened. Like, the union is not doing backflips because their executive director was, you know, shtupping his sister-in-law and everyone found out about it. That being said, if Bruce is the one who had resigned for whatever reason, it would have a bigger impact on negotiations than Tony resigning. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, I also think that, I mean, Bruce said it himself, that he basically kind of got the point across that you're saying. I think he said, like, this isn't nothing. We're not going to acknowledge that this isn't going to cause some amount of disruptions. But he also was like, well, there have been some stuff hanging over us. And to get that dealt with sooner rather than later and all at once, meaning clearly what has been uncovered in addition to whatever links to this federal investigation, that moving on from that sooner rather than later is probably not a bad thing. So they still have to pick up the pieces and figure out the direction that they're going to go. But I do agree, because Bruce has already been at the top of this and because all this other leadership has already kind of been working on these things, in theory, it shouldn't change that much.
I also think it's worth noting, right? Like, you know, I had a couple people ask me, how did Bruce and General Counsel Matt Nussbaum not know about Tony's alleged financial improprieties with the charity and with this other licensing? Like, those investigations are still ongoing. And I do, like, I'm not, maybe I'm a mark, but like, I do believe that they didn't know or weren't fully informed to the extent of what he was doing. Like, Tony Clark doing these player development youth camp side quests as executive director with, like, without the involvement of Bruce, is like, that makes sense to me. Bruce was not this is not the type of guy who's going to clinics and hitting fungos. Okay. Like, he is concerned about the CBA at the major league level and at the minor league level. That is the job. That is his specific role. He is not thinking about the future of baseball as it pertains to, like, youth development. Right. And so I'm like, could he have had more oversight? Yes, maybe. But as far as I understand it, Bruce has not been accused of any wrongdoing related to the ongoing investigations. And I think that is relevant and part of the reason why players were comfortable enough to vote him unanimously as the next executive director.
Yeah. And to that point, I was going to say, that was the last thing I was going to say about this, is just like, the interim tag is important. The timing is important. It would not be surprising if, once we get past these negotiations, that one of those other players in a leadership role, whether it is a Slowey, Andrew Miller, I mean, those guys are right. They're around all the time. If you see the MLPA moving in packs, those two in particular are always there. That was true at, maybe I'm making too much of this, but, you know, at the Royals complex after this happened, so the PA met with all the players. And there was kind of an overlap between that and clubhouse time, because it had kind of run over. We go in there. There's a lot of former players in there. It's not just Slowey and Andrew Miller. But once we kind of settled in for the little media scrum with the reporters, it was a much smaller group of the PA group. And Slowey and Miller are in that kind of inner circle, right? Both of them have been kind of promoted within leadership in recent years. There's also, of course, several of those top legal counsel who I admittedly do not recognize as easily as I recognize Kevin Slowey and Andrew Miller.
They didn't pitch.
Yeah. And they didn't pitch. And, you know, one of them's not.
Andrew Miller, by the way.
Yeah.
A couple things. Andrew Miller, easy to recognize because he is 6'6". and drippy. Like Andrew Miller, love his style. It's pretty LL Bean coded, but he's bringing like an aesthetic that, because most of the guys are wearing, you know, quarter zips and like dry fit pants because these are baseball people. Andrew Miller looks like, you know, he's going on a hike in a catalog in Massachusetts in October.
We love Kevin Slowey also, but yeah, I mean, Andrew Miller would be kind of a perfect, who's as also a particularly tall big leaguer who had, you know, a couple time all-star, very memorable, like feels like he is part lived of this generation every, of baseball.
He lived every baseball life. And I do think that that is relevant in terms of like,
yeah,
him being qualified to do this in the future.
Yeah,
I do think just a couple other quick things here as the union moves forward. From a PR perspective, like they need to break from Tony Clark as hard as possible. And that is maybe like my biggest critique thus far is that like, I think that some of the comments from Bruce were a little bit too kind to Tony, not in terms of like what he did or did not accomplish, but like we cannot be portraying Tony as the victim here. Like, this is a mistake of his own doing.
I don't.
I'm not saying that Bruce was portraying him as the victim. But like the idea that, like, if he is the one who got the union in the muck in the first place, whether that's from a legal perspective or from, you know, these misdeeds, like, we need to be a little bit more upfront. Like, Tony made a mistake. Tony did wrong. Tony erred, right? And maybe that is tied up in like the legal conversation that's been ongoing. Whatever. But I just think that a break there is necessary to wash the hands of what has transpired here. Because look, this is embarrassing. This is embarrassing. No matter how you cut it, whether or not it impacts bargaining or not, having your executive director leave at this juncture in the process is embarrassing. And frankly, it is insulting to the players, to the major leaguers and the minor leaguers, to stand shoulder to shoulder with these dudes in bargaining and advocate for them and play up the importance of this thing that honestly for listeners is like, why do I care about this? Tony Clark is always trying to like up the, he moved with a moral superiority at all times, right? Like kind of like Aslan. Someone compared him to Aslan to me from Narnia. And for him to just negate all of that because he was like too horny is just so insulting to the process and like belittles and just kind of denigrates everything that he was asking players to do over the years. And I don't know. I'm just like pissed at Tony Clark. Maybe that's just not a professional way to think about it.
No, I mean, it's like, I'm sure that Bruce and co are quite angry as well. And I'm going to give Bruce a little bit more grace in terms of the immediate comments on Wednesday.
Sure,
and he
fair.
Did say that we're disappointed. And I mean, I know the question posed to him was like, do you feel betrayed? And I don't think he said like, I feel betrayed, but they said like, yes, I am disappointed. We are personally upset. This is surprising, shocking, all these things. And, you know, when he's also asked, what's Tony Clark's legacy? I don't know what the best way to answer that is in the moment immediately after. It's supposed to be like Tony Clark was never here. We will never act like he was ever a part of any of this. Like, I don't know what he's supposed to say in that example. So I agree moving forward. I think that's just naturally going to happen because he's out of the picture.
Yeah.
And they have to figure out how to portray competence and solidarity and leadership. I mean, that's the goal now.
Fair or not, this is Tony Clark's legacy. He will be remembered for how he exited.
Yeah, like, I think that's fair.
You know,
that's fair. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, maybe so, that's not
and when,
you know, unfortunate.
And when he exited. So, no, yeah. I'm
so that's
you.
The deal.
So anyway,
again, like, do you feel more or less certain that there's going to be games missed? I don't know. I'm not sure. Really, I'm not. I don't know. I'm feeling more pessimistic right now as I sit about where things stand. I don't know why I waver. We'll talk about this more kind of as the season unfolds. But like my general view on labor negotiations, and I've said this to people both at the league and the union, is it just feels like fans get side, like pushed to the side in the whole thing, where it's like league versus union, league versus union. And I saw a tweet from someone that was like, I don't care how much these players make, and I don't care how much these owners make, right? And I do think right. that is a sentiment amongst fans. It's like, I'm not getting the money. The money's not ending up in my pocket. Why should I care about all this? And we'll do our best to kind of explain why and also like hold the union and the league to account for talking past the fans at certain points and not understanding that like who ends up, whether the, you know, who ends up richer is not necessarily pertinent all the time to people that are paying for tickets. But that'll obviously, you know, dominate our lives over the next 365 days plus.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's exactly the problem. You mentioned, I'm not getting them. I know you're. Fans are the people paying for the product. So if the product's not there for any reason, that's not good. That's what people do not want. Now, naturally, it's going to come up into some amount of blaming in some direction. But we will get there when we get there. But I do agree that that is kind of like the real challenge here in this whole situation is that the fans, which everyone says, players say it. The league says it whenever they're speaking publicly. Our game is about our fans. We are trying to serve our fans. Well, none of this is going to be serving the fans particularly well from either side, and we will kind of grapple with that once we actually get into that super fun conversation next winter. But it'll come up as the season goes on, and I do think as Bruce becomes a more public speaking figure, there is a lot of pressure on him to say the right things. I'm not that it's necessarily going to change how negotiations are going to go, but it can impact. I mean, sometimes things that Tony Clark has said, because he's the voice of the union, has become a news cycle for better or for worse in terms of fans understanding the player's position. So now Bruce has the opportunity to do that, but also, you know, the potential pitfalls of speaking publicly more often, because that is not always an easy thing to do, especially for someone who wasn't necessarily expecting to be taking on that role entering this final year of the contract. So anyway, thank you for giving us that rundown. Obviously, Jake has written about this already at Yahoo. I kind of gave the boots on the ground. What did Bruce say? So if you want to read more of those quotes, you can go check that out. Coverage at Yahoo Sports and more to come. All right. Before we take a break and bring in our special guest. Oh, my goodness. What's the opposite of labor negotiations? Fantasy baseball, folks. A little fantasy baseball conversation, as I imagine some people are starting to draft. And Yahoo Fantasy is the place to do it. This is, and by the way, like, this is just objectively true. Like, I have so many people that play fantasy baseball, and I'm like, yeah, Yahoo's the best place to do it. And now there are some new features at Yahoo Fantasy Baseball you should definitely know about. Upgraded commissioner draft tools, commissioners, everything you need to manage your draft in one place. Easier roster management. There is a new pitcher calendar. Oh, this is so important. Like, the number of times I've had a pitcher on the bench.
Is one of the commissioner draft tools get yelled at by Bruce Meyer?
I don't think you have to worry about that in fantasy baseball. Lucky you.
Okay. There's no union.
Pitcher calendar. Yes, you can make sure you know exactly which games pitchers are starting with. You make smarter lineup decisions. And yes, the fantasy feed. Make sure that your fantasy baseball experience is a social first community. Join the conversation. Follow live plays. Connect with millions of fans. Talk some smack.
Do it.
Your team is better than the other teams until it isn't. Anyway, with all that said, we got a little fantasy baseball conversation coming up with Yahoo Fantasy's own Scott Pianowski. We're going to take a break and we'll be back with Scott. Welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. We are now very excited to be joined by Yahoo Fantasy analyst Scott Pianowski. Scott, it's your Barbacast debut. No pressure. You are here to talk some ball with us, get us excited for the fantasy baseball season. Scott, how long have you been playing fantasy baseball?
Oh, man. It goes back to, I think Wade Boggs was my first pick, so that gives you an idea.
Whoa!
can't say the same. Can't like say you were Wade Boggs was my first pick.
Like, you were doing it on spreadsheets, like on pieces of paper. Like, you
word processor. I was the commissioner of the first league I ran. And not only did I run it on a word processor, but we had a rule that when you made a trade, you inherited the stats of the players you traded for. So very suspiciously, I was the champion of my first league. It's still an asterisk, and people still wonder if the stats were done correctly. Yeah, we used to get the USA Today and Tuesday and Wednesday and get together and all that stuff. Yeah, so Yahoo made our life a lot easier when the internet came around.
Here's the thing, Scott. I think that as you've continued on for a career in fantasy, I think you validated those early fantasy results. I don't think people are doubting that you are some sort of fraud in this space. I'm quite confident that you have proven that you know what you're talking about when it comes to fantasy baseball. So that is why you're here. You're here to help us get ready for the fantasy baseball season. We are going to start at the top of the rankings, and then we're going to go to some deep cuts. And again, I think when we talk about fantasy baseball, I know I've played a lot more fantasy baseball in recent years than Jake has, but it is a good avenue to just talk about breakouts and sleepers and players we think are getting good proxy for being like, no, that guy's way better than 140 or whatever. So we'll get to those, but let's start at the top, because I think when you think fantasy baseball, you think, you know, power speed combinations, well-rounded offensive mm-hmm. players. And at the top of this year's rankings, and I mean, this is also true in just the top of the rankings of, again, baseball players, I think that there's an interesting conversation to be had about the three players at the top, and Aaron Judge, Shohei Ohtani, the hitter. Let's focus on Ohtani, the hitter, and Bobby Witt Jr., because all three of these guys have a very interesting track record, I think, particularly when it comes to stealing bases. And so I'll start this broadly with you. Was this a tough decision to rank these three, Judge 1, Ohtani 2, Bobby Witt Jr. 3?
Witt was always my 3. Although certainly range of outcomes, he could be the top player in fantasy baseball. You're not getting the supporting cast in Kansas City that rivals what the Yankees and Dodgers have. And with Witt, it's a little bit on the come that you're hoping that maybe his best season is yet to come, where we have some more proof of concept with Judge and Ohtani. But my incredibly hedgy and probably unsatisfying answer is that if I was given the top pick in 10 different fantasy leagues, I would split it somewhere with Judge and Ohtani. I might take Judge 6 times. I might take Ohtani 4 times. I certainly wouldn't go all in one side or the other. Judge is a few years older. Ohtani has the rigors of pitching, but he also doesn't play the field, which maybe mitigates some of that injury risk. The Dodgers, we know, they have 9 toes in the playoffs already, so load management is something they'll consider. That's more of something they do with their pitching staff, but it may affect their lineup. Some older guys there, Ohtani in his 30s now, Betts and Freeman are actually at ages where I'm a little bit nervous to draft them. But I slightly remember that Judge was the better fantasy player last year. We're only talking about the offense. Remember in Yahoo, Ohtani is split between a utility hitter and a pitcher. So if you draft Ohtani as a hitter, you don't get any of his pitching stats. He also won't cover a position for you, so he may give you a little bit less roster flexibility. The Dodgers have to deal with that as well. Of course, when you're as great as Ohtani, nobody cares. But to me, it's like a 60-40 slight favorite to Judge, just because I feel a little bit better about him maybe playing a full season. And also, Ohtani, you have to ask yourself, is he the base-stealing maven he was 2 years ago, or is he the player he downshifted to last year? A lot of times players just decide, I'm going to steal bases this year. I mean, who saw Juan Soto leading the National League in steals last season because he just felt like doing it? So you have to kind of reconcile how many bases he's going to steal. Judges said he's like to steal more as well. He'll probably get 10 to 15 on my sheet, but who knows? Maybe he'll push that into the 20s. I slightly lean Judge. Witt's my 3. Soto's my 4. And honestly, I'd love to have one of those top 4 picks, because I think there's a little bit of a drop off in the second half of the first round, but there's no wrong answers with that first spot.
So I got to say, like, I was actually a little bit surprised, because if, as someone who's not as, you know, looped into this world, if you made me draft a team tomorrow and I had the first pick, I would take Bobby Witt. And I probably wouldn't think that hard about it, just because of the positional value, the bankability of his stolen bases versus those other two. Aaron Judge could say he wants to steal more bases. Like, I want to go to the gym more and eat better. Like, all right. Like, I'll believe it when I see it. And I don't think Ohtani's really going to run anymore ever again now that he's pitching. And then the last component, I'm curious if this, you know, folded into your evaluation at all. Like, they've moved the fences in Kansas City, like, pretty significantly. Now, that was one of the hardest parks, if not the hardest park to hit at. Do you think that will benefit Bobby Witt in a significant enough way where maybe he could end up the season as the number one fantasy player?
It's certainly part of the equation. What are you getting with Witt, okay, that you're not getting with the other two guys? he's into his age 26 season. He's closer to his theoretical peak than Judge and Ohtani are. We have not seen the best Bobby Witt season yet. The park changes have to be factored in. Interesting. You mentioned the positional value. And, you know, I realize when you're doing like war components and everything, shortstops, they're more valuable. The thing about fantasy is there's so many good offensive shortstops now. And we talked about, you know, my fantasy career and how far back it goes. When I first started playing fantasy, you were happy if your shortstop hit 10 home runs, hit 12 home runs. We don't have that problem anymore. These guys hit for average. They hit for power. They hit for speed. So it's not – nobody is going to go into their fantasy draft thinking, oh, my God, I can't find a shortstop I like. You're going to find one whenever you draft one. Now, in the first round, you're just trying to get the best stats. The positions really don't matter so much. To me, the reason why Witt's three – to me, and this is also a case where you might say, if you might be in a league where you can pick your slot, and you might say, you know what, give me the third pick because I want Bobby Witt Jr. I think he can be the number one overall player, and I'm going to sit out the Judge Ohtani stuff. I just don't – I can't look at that Kansas City offense and feel the same way I do about the Yankees offense and the Dodgers offense, where the lineup's going to turn over more often. The bottom three or bottom four are still really good hitters who would be – top five hitters on other teams. I want that infrastructure. I want them to be insulated by, when I say lineup protection, isn't that, oh, well, they're afraid of everybody else. They're going to pitch to you. It's more like, I want people on base when I come up, and I want people to knock me in when I'm on base. And I think Bobby Witt's always going to have that problem. And look, I like Vinny Pasquantino, and you know, Garcia made a nice leap last year, but they don't have the 1-9 depth that the Yankees and Dodgers offer. So that I hold that against Witt a little bit, but you know, every year when I draft, I think to myself, draft younger, draft guys on the escalator, draft guys who could have their MVP season this year. Soto certainly checks that box, and he's a great pick at three or at four. If you want to say you want to draft Witt because he's, you know, a beat younger than these guys, the park, he's also somebody who may hit 340. He can steal as many bases as he wants. He's got 35 home run power. I mean, Bobby Witt Jr. has no gaps in his game. I just wish he had better people to run with in Kansas City.
I want to now ask about the pitching, because all winter long, Jordan and I have, when we talk about the best pitchers in the world, and Jordan can attest to this, like I've said, there's a clear five, right? Like a no doubt quintet of Skubal, Skeens, Crochet, Sanchez, Yamamoto. And I love that you have that exact group 1-5. Was there any debate about the ordering of those five? Or was it clear to you pretty early on that this group was going to be above the rest?
Yeah, I like the Fab Five approach with this starting pitching rank. I could – Yamamoto and Sanchez is maybe where the inflection point is for me, where I could go either way on that. But when you talk about pitching, you know, there have been years I've gone into fantasy baseball drafts and said, I'm going to be the last guy to take a pitcher. I'm just going to – the position is filled with injuries. It's filled with variance. I don't want to mess with that. You can get lucky with pitching every year, but – I've changed my tune on that. I think three or four picks into a draft, I want to have at least one pitcher. Maybe six picks in, I want to have at least two pitchers. Probably won't take a pitcher in the first round, which means I'm out of the Skubal and Skeens business, and there's nothing fun about that. But if Crochet would get to me in the second round, I'd be really interested. Obviously, Yamamoto coming off a great season and unbelievable playoffs, how heroic he was at the end of the World Series. We all saw that even with the Dodgers generally wanting to be careful with their pitching, I think you can put a decent innings pitch projection on him. I've changed my stance from what if my pitchers get hurt? What if they break my heart? What if the variance gets me, to more like what if I have the right guys, right? It's a little bit like in fantasy baseball where people used to think I can't draft running backs early. They get hurt too much. And then people would finish their season and say, oh, who won the league? Oh, the guy with the best running backs. I kind of feel that way about starting pitchers in fantasy baseball. I think you want a number one, a front man. And again, it may not be Skubal or Skeens. You may not have a draft slot that makes sense for those guys. Your number one could be Hunter Brown. It could be Logan Webb. It could be one of the Seattle pitchers. And obviously you want to have your guys in an advantageous park like those guys are in Seattle. It's a big advantage. But I've become more proactive with pitching, and I think those top five that you mentioned are certainly the guys that I'm targeting as well.
Let's go farther down the list, and we'll go a little rapid fire here. We're going to go beyond the top 100, and if we want to go farther down, we can. I know you and Fred Zinke had your composite top 250. I guess it probably goes even farther than top 250. But if you look up, you know, top 250 fantasy rankings on Yahoo, very easy to find. So that's what we're going to go off of. And again, we're thinking about this as much as just general breakouts, but obviously this can contribute to fantasy success as well. So I'll start with you, Scott. Who's someone outside the top 100? Now, obviously, in your case, because these are your rankings, if you really loved them, maybe you would have put them in the top 100. But that said, who's someone outside the top 100 that you maybe wish, like, oh, you know what? I actually wish I could put him a little bit higher. Hitter or pitcher, give us one.
I'll give you somebody who I think is misranked. So Andrew Abbott right now is the number 180 pick in Yahoo ADP. That's the average draft position of drafts that already. And of course, you can join your league in Yahoo, set it up, and draft today, draft tomorrow, mock draft. There's a bunch of new features in the game this year. Can't wait for you to take it on a spin. Do a lot more on your phone as well, including set up draft times. I want you to check all that out. Andrew Abbott was the number 23 starting pitcher in fantasy value last year. He's not priced like it. And the reason why is, okay, he pitches in Cincinnati. He's a fly ball pitcher. We get nervous about that. But because he has such heavy fly ball tendencies, he's exhibiting control over his outcomes. And that it doesn't really matter if you're a heavy ground ball guy. We like ground balls. They can't become home runs. You get double plays. I get all that. But the pitchers with high fly ball rates are actually exhibiting dominance over their outcomes too. Abbott is what I call a regress and win player. What does that mean? It means that he can get worse than he was last year and still be a profit at his ADP. I think the 180 ADP in Yahoo is a steal right now. He'll have an ERA somewhere in maybe 3.3, 3.4 range. He'll be a decent strikeout pitcher. The Reds were a competitive team last year. They snuck into the playoffs. They were in there for about 15 seconds, but it doesn't matter. I think you're getting an unbelievable bargain. Again, he can get worse than he was last year and still return a profit at ADP. I have a big circle around Andrew Abbott.
That is definitely a good one. Jake, give me a pitcher.
Oh, I mean, this guy is in the top 100, but he is too low. Jordan probably already knows who I'm talking about. I just want to make a point. Nolan McClain. Nolan McClain, if I was playing fantasy baseball, I would be taking Nolan McClain irrationally high. I think he's going to win a lot of games. He's going to throw a lot of innings. If he had made like three more starts last year, I think he would be a top 10 pitcher already. I'm irrationally high on the guy. Other arms that stand out for me, Yuri Perez is probably who Jordan was going to say. Are similarly high on him. Nope, not who Jordan was going to say. Similarly high on Yuri Perez.
I love Yuri, but other one, how many?
Shane Boz pops out at me all the way down in the 200s as someone who was brought into the Orioles to be the number one guy. Like he's going to be asked to throw a lot of innings and pitch a lot of games, and I think that I'm high on him for this upcoming season.
Let me piggyback on a couple of things that you said. I'm with McClain, Mets starter. We're very excited about him. You talked about what if he pitched a little bit more last year, maybe the cover would have been blown. I love players like that. Like, why is Zach Neto available in the third round? Because he missed about a month of the season and his final stats weren't what they should have been. Jeremy Pena is a player like that. He's going two or three rounds later. Willie Abreu got hurt in Boston. He was going to hit 30 home runs. He's unbelievably inexpensive. So sometimes when just because a guy didn't have a full season and it kind of misrepresents what his true value is, I think that's a great target and a great reason to go after guys. And who was the second player you mentioned? It's something I want to say about him too.
Boz, Yuri Perez.
Or Boz.
Perez, Yuri Perez. Okay. One of our favorite things in fantasy baseball is a post-type sleeper. And that's a guy who we're all excited about. And then he either pitches poorly or plays poorly, gets hurt, Tommy John, whatever it is. He's off the radar. And then when he comes back, everybody's like, okay, on to the new next shiny toy. And you love drafting. Sometimes it's kind of risky to draft those guys when they're the hot thing. But when they're a little bit on the back burner and Miami's a little bit of an anonymous team, Yuri Perez is going to go outside the top 200 in drafts. And he has the upside to be a top 25 fantasy starter. Everything we liked about him two or three years ago still applies today. We love targeting post-type sleepers in fantasy baseball.
I love Yuri Perez as well. I know, again, it depends what kind of league you're in. Do wins matter? Who knows if you can even project those? But I'm glad you mentioned kind of the post-type sleeper, because the pitcher I wanted to mention is a little Ohio bias here, but it's Gavin Williams. Mm-hmm. I know he had a ton of walks last year, but I feel like last year he was like a sneaky sleeper, and I feel like he delivered. I feel like he pretty much gave you what you were hoping for, struck out a ton of guys, had an ERA around 3, pitched 170 innings, and got better as the season went on. And so I am surprised that he is not being considered a little bit more of a sure thing at this point after the season that he just had. So he's outside the top 100. And again, I know the command is going to scare off some people, but I'm a big believer in Gavin Williams. So he's also something I would consider a little bit higher.
I like Gavin Williams too. I think what makes people a little bit nervous sometimes, the 306 ERA, but the FIP was 4.39. So people point to him maybe being fortunate with the batted ball outcomes last year. But Cleveland is a team that generally does little things well. They play defense well. They obviously stole, I don't know how they stole the AL Central last year from Detroit, but they did with that unbelievable finish at the end of the season. Usually a playoff team. At least they're just selling that to Jose Ramirez, man. He took a pretty big discount to stay on a Cleveland team that I'm not sure about their offense, although I think Stephen Kwan is always underrated. Eat your vegetables, pick around pick 170. But I do like targeting Williams. I also think Cade Smith might be a round or two mispriced at closer. He's obviously going to be their guy. They've moved on from the situation last year. He certainly could handle the lights of the ninth inning. I think he's probably the cheapest 40 saves you can find on the board this season.
Let's do some hitters quickly before we get out of here. I'm going to go ahead and do one that a year ago we were even like not in a specific fantasy context. I know we were hyping up, and I think he delivered, and that's Yvonne Herrera with the St. Louis Cardinals. Obviously, the again, supporting cast is a bit TBD there for sure, but he completely delivered on that small sample that he showed us in 24. All the underlying stuff says that this dude just absolutely rakes. And I don't know how much he's actually going to catch for the Cardinals, but as long as he has catcher eligibility, I have to imagine he's an extremely valuable target because of what he's been able to show with the bat. I mean, he seems like a very bankable, well above average hitter that is going much later.
You hit some words that I love. I love catcher eligible players who may not have to catch a lot because it's a very demanding position physically. And we're at a time in the league, right? I think most of the major offensive catchers now get DH time, get first base time when they're not catching. So it used to be when you drafted your catcher, okay, maybe he'll get 400 at bats. Now these guys can sail past 500 at bats when you're as good as Cal Raleigh. You're going to play every day. But some of these other guys are going to get 500. They're going to qualify for the batting title and all that stuff. I think Herrera is an interesting target, somebody I'm curious about.
The guys I was going to say fit the same exact mold, which is Carter Jensen in Kansas City and Samuel Basayo in Baltimore. Two younger catchers with a lot of offensive upside, probably not going to be the primary catcher, but are probably going to hit and be in the lineup 5 or 6 days a week.
Love that. Again, we're always looking. I remember maybe 10, 15 years ago, Brandon Inge was a catcher eligible player in Yahoo, and he hit 27 home runs playing third base. We're always looking to, you know, and Yahoo has the most flexible position eligibility rules in the industry. So you're probably going to have more fun playing a little bit positionless. Like, you know, think of a basketball team where you play positionless basketball. You can do that a little bit in fantasy baseball. Even though St. Louis is down, they win 72 games last year, something like that. They're projected to be even worse this year. J.J. Weatherholt, one of the favorites for Rookie of the Year. They've traded Arenado. They've traded Donovan. So he's going to fit in that infield somewhere. He was a high first-round pick. He's got power. He's got speed. I think he'll hit for a decent average. You know, everybody, the development curve is different for every player, and some guys hit the ground running, some guys don't. But I think Weatherholt is going to be a full-time player. I think he's going to hit in the top half of the lineup, and I think he probably has 15 homers and 15 steals right out of the box.
We love JJ so much. One of our favorites. I was so disappointed he did not get a chance to debut last year, but totally agree. He is, I think he's going to win Rookie of the Year. So not really a hot take at all, but I am taking him over Connor Griffin because I just think he's going to play right away, and I think he's going to be awesome. But hey, maybe Connor Griffin will too, and maybe Connor Griffin will just be talking about him a top 10 fantasy player a year from now after he stole, 70 bases in the minors last year. So we will see. We will see what happens with him. All right, Scott, this was so much fun. Thank you so much for joining us. Make sure you check out Yahoo Fantasy Baseball. Check out Scott's rankings and all kinds of fun new features. I'm looking forward to drafting here soon. Thanks, Scott.
Thanks for having me, guys. Big fan of your show, and it was really fun to talk ball with you today.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. We will do good, bad, ugly momentarily, but Jordan, you've been out and about in Arizona, and you would like to hold our hand and take us around the league.
Let's begin with a bit of news that I was not present for. I did not make it to Brewers camp, unfortunately, in my week in the desert. However, we have some manager news. Pat Murphy, ever heard of him? The back-to-back manager of the year. A guy who, this is actually a good combination of topics, because we're going to talk about Tony Vitello here in a second. But Pat Murphy, of course, a legendary career as a college coach, then spends a long time in the minors, eventually gets elevated to major league manager with the Milwaukee Brewers. And now, after two tremendously successful years at the helm, taking over for Craig Counsell, he receives a contract extension, 3-year contract, almost $9 million in new money. He is one of the highest paid managers in baseball now. And I think the one thing I just kind of wanted to talk about with Murph is, like, I'm kind of struggling with this just as we talk about the Brewers, because at this point, clearly Murph is, he's certainly not hurting matters in Milwaukee. I think he has managed to kind of cultivate a leadership figure and kind of an energy and a mentality with this group that has clearly worked. And how many of their 96 wins or whatever it was last year deserve to be his credit? Who's to say? But it has been very cool to see an era of Brewers baseball that was first kind of defined by, like, kind of the silent assassin tactician that was Craig Counsell, and is now just the opposite, this boisterous personality that is Pat Murphy. And for that, I have certainly enjoyed since he has become a main character in Major League Baseball.
And I do think it is compelling within the context of, like, a growing frustration within Brewerland that the Brewers are not going for it, or they are constantly cycling through players. And I think that absolutely behind the scenes, Pat Murphy is frustrated about that dynamic. Like, obviously he wanted to keep Freddie Peralta and Caleb Durbin and co and whoever, but he understands the realities of this job. And, you know, it's as good of a setup as he's going to get. And that's part of why he signed an extension. Like, not every job is perfect. And I do think that Murphy is the perfect person to lead this particular operation, to get the guys that are still around that were not traded away to believe in the process. He is, above all, a stellar salesman, and I imagine will continue to succeed at that in Milwaukee moving forward. From one former college skipper to another, Giants manager Tony Vitello had his first kerfuffle this week. The former head ball coach at the University of Tennessee, notably hopped over to the pro side this winter, taking the gig with the Giants, left Tennessee in bizarre fashion and offered just a weird rant this week, where he wanted to clear up some things about where things stood and the kind of the chronology, the timeline of his exit from Tennessee. It got a lot of questionable, like, people were confused and perplexed by this. It did come across a little bit oddly. Jordan, what did you make of this whole situation?
Yeah, I think the timing was as bizarre as anything. So for those who didn't see essentially what happened, now, I was not there that day. I did spend a couple of days at Giants camp, and so I definitely have some big picture thoughts about Tony that I'm going to share here, but I was not there the day that this happened, but my understanding as to what occurred was, again, as is the case before, you know, every regular season game, even in spring training, the manager speaks every morning. And so they plop down in the dugout and they, you know, field questions from the media about who's looking good, who threw well in a sim game, and who's injured and who's not in camp yet because of visa issues, you know, all that fun early spring training stuff, right? We're not even at games yet. Spring training games start today, folks. But Tony Vitello, all of this is new to him, right? So this whole experience, every day he's kind of talking about something that he's never been asked about, and kind of learning how major league organizations work and what the kind of routine and the tone and the rhythm of a spring training is. So all that is understandable, and those adjustments are completely natural. However, as you mentioned, his exit from Tennessee at the end of last season, in the middle of their kind of fall practices, to take this job, one of the most shocking, if not the most shocking hire of this very busy managerial carousel cycle. It seems that Tony is still bothered by how that information came out. And so what happened was he sat down for his morning meeting, and before anyone started asking him questions, he said, speaking, I believe, directly to Susan Slusser, although it seemed like he was kind of addressing everybody in the group, being like, when did you think I accepted this job? When did you think I was taking this job? And Susan, and as well as some of the others, were like, well, 4 days before it was announced, which is when the initial Athletic article came out, which was, I guess, not from Susan, but there were several reports in sort of the 3 or 4 days before. And then Tony essentially went on this 3 to 4 minute monologue about how that was incorrect and how actually he was still weighing the options and he can't believe that any amount of this was leaked. And obviously it's not that people knew that they were talking to him, but he clearly has this discomfort with the fact that this very personal and difficult decision for him was being told in real time. There's two conversations here. One is what he is actually specifically referring to, which is the nature of reporting in Major League Baseball and how these things get out and the sharing of information and how accurate it is at certain exact moments in time. That is one thing that I guess to some degree was being discussed after he brought this up again, right? That is one thing that we could discuss. However, I actually don't think that's really that important at this stage, because what is more relevant and more interesting and I think more insightful is the fact that he's even still thinking about this at all, right? Why he decided to go out of his way to address this months later when he has already talked about how it was a tough decision and like, I don't doubt that at all. And I'm sure he was frustrated, and that's his right, you know, as he kind of transitions into a much more different role, not just in terms of the baseball thing, but in terms of what the responsibilities are and how much more of a spotlight and the number of different people that are involved in your decision making and your life and your job is so much greater when you're the manager of the San Francisco Giants or about to maybe become the manager of the San Francisco Giants than when you are essentially the top dog in Knoxville because of what you've accomplished.
I don't understand what he was trying to say. And that's the biggest takeaway for me. Like, it was just incoherent. And I like Tony, but it just didn't make sense. And I was like, what are you saying? Like, I literally did not understand what he was saying. And so I don't even know how to comment on this whole thing besides saying, like, Tony's, and I think he will, he's going to have to make an adjustment. That's the upshot here, is that this is going to take time. It was never going to be this swift transition. There were going to be some rocky moments, and we knew that as people who were around the college game for a long time. Like, we knew what Tony V was going to be and what he has been. There's goods and there's bads, and, you know, it was never going to move smoothly. All right, Jordan, let us do the best part of the week, and that is the good, the bad, and the ugly.
Something good, something bad, something ugly. My good is Sean Manaea. What was Sean Manaea up to this week? Well, apparently, attending a baseball game played by his alma mater, Indiana State. Indiana State was playing a game at Miami, and Sean Manaea was like, you know how I want to take in this game? In the Sycamore bullpen. Caught on the ACC Network broadcast, Sean Manaea in his Sean Manaea attire. Wearing some Vans there? He's just hanging out. In the middle of a very close ball game. And while this is good because I love Sean Manaea, when you're a big leaguer and you went to the school, even on the road, you get to show up and just do whatever you want. Like, that's good. I will say it is hard not to notice the bad/ugly element of this, which is, I don't know how long he was sitting in the bullpen, but this inning really unraveled for the Sycamores. went on to allow. As you can see, the screenshot, they entered the inning down 3-2. They ended the inning down 6-2. So I don't know how long Manaea was sitting there. I don't know if how he awkwardly departed. But there is something quite funny about that he had to watch, I think, multiple pitching changes. A home run was allowed. And so that part is kind of maybe a little bit awkward. So, but Sean Manaea,
my
respect,
favorite thing about
I love this.
This photo, if we could bring it back up for people watching on YouTube, is the size difference. Manaea is sitting down and is obviously 10 years older than these college kids. He is so much larger, dude. He's so much bigger.
Big boy.
And this is a great reminder of the physicality you need to be a big leaguer compared to like Indiana State. And it makes me think about what it must have been like for him to have played there, right? Like, he was such a unicorn in that sense at that program.
Yeah. This is the other funny thing I was thinking. I was like, Sean Manaea, I don't believe ever came out of the bullpen one time in college. So
incredible.
Obviously warmed up there, I'm sure, a few times, but I just thought that whole thing was funny. So that's good for me. College baseball's back, baby.
For me, it's gong time. Let's gong it up. Padres camp. I'm just going to read straight from an article from AJ Casavell at MLB.com because he nails the lead on this. After a flurry of moves to round out their roster, there's excitement ringing out throughout Padres camp. You can hear it. Or maybe that sound is the Padres-themed gong that has worked its way into throwing drills this spring. There is a video going around, really, of the Padres doing pickoff move practice where the gong is like where the first baseman should be, and the Padres guys are doing pickoff moves and just throwing the ball against the gong, and it rings out if you hit it right in the center. Awesome. This is awesome. I used to do certain things like this with Little League kids where you want to like give, it's better for kids, right? Like audible, tangible, like stimuli for success and failure. So it's like, oh, you hear the sound and that was whatever. This is great. Spring training is boring. More musical instruments involved in drills.
It's also perfect because this on the ground, you know, other throwing drills, if you're just regularly throwing to first base or even at home, there's a little bit more of a like a wide range of where the ball can go. But this is perfect because if you're going to pick someone off, you really do have to throw it to a very, very, very specific spot. And so yeah. I love using this. This is good. Shout out
play.
Craig Stammen. I don't know if it was Craig Stammen's idea, but I wasn't seeing them do this with Mike Schilt. So shout out to my guy, Ohio legend, Craig Stammen. Let's do it.
At Petco Park this year, every time there's a pickoff move, they should do like a gong sound and, you know, like a video board thing.
Yeah, I'm curious, like how many guys did they pick off like literally all of last season? I will look that up later. Let's go to bad. My bad this week is just more sad than bad. Chris Bryant is just still hurt, folks. I mean, this just sucks. Chris Bryant, who is with the Rockies, of course, still 7-year contract. He has only played 170 games since he signed that contract. He is now entering the fifth year of said contract. But unfortunately, Chris Bryant has been dealing with a degenerative lumbar condition in his lower back, and he just can't really do anything. And that really sucks. And I think that this is sad in and of itself because it's like Chris Bryant was a great player and now he can't play baseball. But I think that now that like the Rockies era is maybe about to change, not that I think the Rockies are suddenly about to be good, but it's even in some ways even more tragic that Chris Bryant does not look like he's going to make it back to maybe play in an era of Rockies baseball that is relevant whatsoever. I know we assumed he was doomed completely because if they weren't going to change anything, they were never going to be good. But now it's like, imagine Paul DePodesta and Josh Burns and Warren Schaefer and, you know, they turn it around and the Rockies are good in 2029 and Chris Bryant could be at the end of his contract and playing and like, you know, the DH or whatever. And instead, it just seems like he just can't play baseball anymore. So bumps me out. He was a heck of a player.
Kids these days, man, they don't know. Kids these days don't know how good Chris Bryant was at his peak. I mean, what? MVP, World Series champion, rookie of the year, Golden Spikes within like a 4-year span.
He accomplished everything you can do in baseball in like 4 years. And then since then, it has just been like, all right, well, nothing more for you to do. And now you are very hurt. Sorry, Chris Bryant.
Let's make fun of the Red Sox. One of our favorite activities on this show. As the Boston Red Sox tweeted and then deleted. What happened here? So a picture came out of the Red Sox jerseys from photo day. Okay. And like the spacing on the words Red Sox were like a little funky on the home white uniforms. And fans noticed and they complained. And then the Red Sox issued a statement. I am reading. As part of the MLB return to the 2023 jersey template, we approved a design for our home white jerseys that once produced and seen in person, we felt could be cleaner and the spacing between the lettering and the piping. In collaboration with MLB and Fanatics, we're adjusting the home whites to restore cleaner separation. The updated jerseys will be ready for opening day. Reasonable, right? They're saying, hey, we tried to like do a little thing. It didn't work. We're going to fix it. And that could have been the end of the story, and we never would have talked about it. Instead, the powers that be at Big Memorabilia, at Big Fanatics, made a phone call. Someone made a phone call, okay? Because the Red Sox then deleted that tweet and changed some of the wording to make it more kind to Fanatics. I'm just going to read the change here. We approved a design for our home white jerseys, which Fanatics produced exactly to our specs. And then they add a line at the end. We are grateful to our partners for their ongoing support. I mean, this is Orwellian, brother. This is like,
did you see the follow-up? Weird. Did you see that they added an even further tweet, which is even more embarrassing? Again, as if that follow-up wasn't, you know, weak enough. They then even added another tweet below that. To be clear, the original design was selected by the Red Sox. Fanatics executed to our specifications and has been an outstanding partner throughout. They deserve no blame, and we are grateful to them for making the new jerseys in time for opening day.
Don't put it in the newspaper that Fanatics got mad at us. I mean...
Oh, so embarrassing. Just so embarrassing.
This is so bad. Red Sox PR, like, it's,
this is quite, I'll just say this, we're going to move on. They have quite the history of deleted tweets. Just going to leave it there. All right, Ugla. Yeah. Syracuse Mets, AAA baseball team, were planning to change their name. No, that's very, happens all the time. Minor league teams are like, you know what? Our minor league team name is boring. Let's change it up. Syracuse Mets were planning to change it. They were about to announce it, and then they said, oops, that's not possible anymore because we had a trademark issue. And so they made this kind of humorous video, self-deprecating, being like, ah, sorry, we screwed up. Sorry, guys, you're going to have to wait until 2028. We are going to remain the Syracuse Mets. It is unclear exactly what the name was. They have not revealed what that was. But this quote from their GM, Jason Smorrell, in this story on Syracuse.com is just so ugly. Well, this is just from the story excerpt. He said the chosen name was unique enough that the Mets didn't expect trademarking to be an issue. He said the conflict did not come from the sports world, but from another business. He declined to reveal what the new name would have been. Quote, we thought the name was out there enough in our world. I guess it wasn't out there for other worlds. In the baseball world, it was no way. So I hope at some point we find out what their original idea is. But either way, it is so funny to me that in an era where teams are just changing all the freaking time, like they are coming up with the most nonsense combinations of words to make their major league, their minor league baseball team. And somehow the Mets managed to not be funky enough, which is really funny. It's like a version where it's like you ask someone for, this is kind of like, you know, cold, bold or whatever. It's like you ask someone for a hot take and they're like, Aaron Judge is going to hit 30 home runs. It's like, no, you gotta get a little more interesting than that. Sorry, well, that was already trademarked.
It seems like there was the way that he says this, it's like there's a trademark issue in another field. So like, were they the Syracuse Baja Blasts or something? Like what? Like, you know, like what were they doing?
I don't know, man. I
the Syracuse quote, just well, do it.
Let's just end with this quote, as ugly as it is. And sorry, you can go. Quote, we'll work with them. They're working with Brandios, of course. That's the same company that comes up with all these goofy minor league team names. Quote, we'll work with them so we don't screw it up again. We're not doing rocket science over here. It's important, but it's not life and death. So true. Great point, Jason Smorrell. Very, very ugly.
It'd be funnier if it was. If he was like, this is life and death. All right, my ugly this week has very little to do with current events. I was having a discussion with someone about the Olympics and baseball and Russia not being in the Olympics. And I looked into the history, Jordan, of Russian baseball, particularly as it pertains to the Soviet Union. And I came across this movie, okay, titled The Comrades of Summer. The Comrades of Summer is a 1992 television film that aired on HBO. And as far as I understand it, the plot to this movie, which I have not watched and I plan to watch at some point this weekend, is that, here we go, Major League Baseball manager Sparky Smith is fired from his job with the Seattle Mariners. His attitude has gotten him to trouble with George, the owner of the Mariners. The Olympic Games are coming up, however, and a spirit of glasnost exists in post-Soviet Russia, which is trying to field its first Olympic baseball team. Sparky reluctantly accepts an offer to move to Moscow to coach the players, many of whom don't even know the game's fundamentals. Just stellar. The VHS box, the tagline for the movie is, "These Reds ain't from Cincinnati."
Ooh, that's good. That's fire.
I fell down a CCCP baseball rabbit hole and would encourage everybody to watch The Comrades of Summer with me. There is also a baseball bat as the hammer on the Soviet hammer and sickle, which is incredible. I'm sure this movie is completely unhinged, and I am so excited for it to be a part of my life.
I am looking at the baseball reference page for Players by Birthplace Russian Federation, and there are 5 players who have appeared in the major leagues who were apparently born in Russia, none in over 100 years. However, I am looking forward to digging in to these 5 individuals after we are done here recording, and maybe if Lyle Miller Green ever makes it to the majors, he can become the 6th. All right. What a fascinatingly strange and random way to end this episode of Baseball Barbacast, but I appreciate that. That is what Uglo is all about. Thank you to Andrew Hartz and Ingrid Rosas for producing. Thank you to Scott Pianowski for joining us talking about fantasy baseball. Make sure you go draft a squad over at Yahoo Fantasy. We encourage that. Email us baseballbarbacast@gmail.com, and we'll be back next week on Monday. 3 times a week resumes next week. So much to talk about. So much to write about, so much to get excited for. WBC is almost here. Thank you all for listening. We will talk to you next week.